Meeting of the House Committee on Civil Law will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Can I have a motion on the minutes?
So moved.
Minutes have been moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion passes. Members, we do have a separate item. Minutes from February 20th that were adopted yesterday. We're missing an oral amendment. So I'd ask a motion to reconsider the vote on the adoption of those minutes.
So moved.
Okay. Motions. What's that? It's been moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. So now I ask for a motion to adopt the new minutes, which do correctly reflect the oral amendment from February 20th.
So moved.
It's been moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Excellent. Okay, members, as you recall, we laid over Representative Allen's House File 252 because we didn't have enough time for debate and vote, and I wanted to get all the testifiers in, so the chair takes up that bill again. Representative Allen, to your bill, House File 252 as amended. We're not going to be having any other questions, so you don't need your testifier. Well, to the extent there is for debate, but there will not be any other testimony on this bill. There will just be debate and vote. So, Representative Allen?
Representative Lesh, we do have one member that, a witness that would like to testify.
I understand the time for that was yesterday, Representative Allen.
All right.
So, and I'm sorry we didn't have enough time for that, but that's why I reserved all the time yesterday for testimony alone. So this will just be debate and vote on the bill.
Chair, good questions as well? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes, questions for members. So, questions from members, questions, comments from members regarding House File 252 as amended.
Yeah.
Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Allen, yesterday I asked a question of the testifiers on the other side about jurisdiction and creating jurisdiction here, because it was my understanding, and I admit I don't know a lot about this topic, but it's my understanding that because the tribes are sovereign nations, that jurisdiction kind of already exists there. And maybe you could just explain just really briefly how that works. Kind of answer my question. If you heard the question yesterday, maybe if you had a comment on what their answer was.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Allen.
Representative Levin. I can comment on that. I'd like to defer that to the Ms. Van Norman, though.
Okay. Ms. Van Norman, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, again, I'm Sarah Van Norman with the law firm of Jacobson Buffalo, here representing the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, who supports the bill. The answer to the question is actually quite simple. Tribes have jurisdiction over any matters that they initially had jurisdiction over before the formation of the United States, except as has been set aside over time through treaties by acts of Congress and other certain federal decisions. That's why we, for example, use the term reservations for the lands that tribes reserved from their initial lands, which were the United States. So, yes, tribes certainly do have retained jurisdiction, and in ICWA have concurrent jurisdiction with matters like this one that's at issue with the bill, with the state.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think that has a lot of bearing on this issue that's before us, because this, as I'm understanding it, this has to do with, as I'm understanding the bill, all it's really doing is kind of clarifying that the tribes and the state have concurrent jurisdiction in this matter. And I see the bill as kind of just trying to basically allow the two sovereignties to work out the issues around this, and so I don't know if other members have comments, but you know, am I kind of understanding it correctly,
Representative Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. That would.
Thank you, Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes to seeing that this has already gone to the state Supreme Court, and I don't know if this is correct, but if this passes and this ends up going again to court, will the Attorney General have to to, I guess, support the state's position or the legislature's position? And if so, have we received a an opinion from the Attorney General as to the validity of the legislation and where we're going with this?
Who wants to field that? Ms. Van Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in fact, the Attorney General's office did take a position in the last go-round because the same scenario was presented, that there was a challenge to, well, in that case, the Minnesota State Tribal Agreement and a number of other provisions of the procedural rules and statute. And the Attorney General took the position that the tribes take here and that is reflected in the proposed amendment. So presumably the Attorney General would do the same thing if in a future challenge.
Representative Howe?
But we haven't passed this by him at this period of time to get an opinion of at this time.
Ms. Van Norman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware that that's happened, no.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need a point of clarification. How is Indian child defined? 100%, 50%, 25%? At what? What is the definition of an Indian child?
Ms. Van Norman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the definition of an Indian child is actually plainly laid out. I can pull it up in the statute if need be, but it's important to remember that it's not about a percentage, and I understand the question about whether that's a subjective definition. If an Indian child is eligible, or if a child is eligible for enrollment in a federally recognized Indian tribe, or is actually enrolled in a federally recognized Indian tribe, then that is an Indian child for purposes of the Indian Child Welfare Act. It is defined exclusively that way. It's not a racial determination. It is solely a political determination.
Representative Neuberger?
Well, the follow-up perhaps to that would be then if let's say the child is 75%. Native American, if there are family members outside of that are not Indian, would they be losing any of their parental rights? Is there, you see what I'm getting at here is, I just want to make sure that this water isn't so muddy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely not the case. No biological parent has, who retains parental rights to a child would have those rights affected in any way by the Indian Child Welfare Act, and there's, in fact, under ICWA cases, a higher emphasis on maintaining kin relationships than you might see under non-Indian children welfare matters.
Representative Neuberger?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Scott?
No questions, just a comment, and thank you, Representative Allen, and your testifiers for being here again today. And I do believe that we're doing the right thing in passing this bill. This arrangement was working so well for so many years, and I think that we need to keep it in place. We've got the agreement of all, but I've heard just one tribe has not weighed in on this, but all of the tribes have agreed, and I think that's kind of a high hurdle to cover on many occasions. So I support what we're trying to do here.
Any questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, then Representative Allen's motion is renewed that House File 252 be recommended to pass as amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Allen.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 642 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection. Representative Mullery also has a similar bill, so we're going to kind of present these together. However, I'd ask if my testifiers can come down first and present this with me, and then we'll take up the vote at the same time so as to be efficient. We can do that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking for Representative Hillstrom, but will this be stopping off in Judiciary as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I don't know.
I believe it's going to the Commerce next.
When she gets back, Madam Chair, if I would be able to ask her that question if she's interested in seeing the bill.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Scott. And Madam Chair, members, House File 642 has been a project of mine for a while, though I've never dropped in a bill. I know that Representative Mullery has dropped in a bill to this effect for several sessions now. And it affects a situation whereby we should be able to expect our Attorney General to defend us from certain actions or help us out with certain actions relating to consumer fraud. Some of these, which are violations of law against citizens, but which we, as citizens, are obligated to have to sue on our own to vindicate our legal rights in the face of what is sometimes a criminal action on the part of another entity. And I will use one example. In the fall of 2010, I had come back from Ranger School and IBOLIC at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I got a call from one of my fellow Ranger students, and he'd said, "Lesh, I need your help. I just saw my car go down the street on a flatbed truck." He had this little old Mazda RX-7 that he was really proud of. It was an old car, kind of a not that great, but it was the only car he had. I said, "Well, what did you do?" And he said, "Nothing." He said, "I bought the car from a guy who purchased it from an auction in California. The lien had been satisfied by him prior to the sale. I bought it as a good faith." Well, he didn't use these words, but he said, "I bought it." He was a good faith purchaser, and in turn, this company, this towing company, said, "Nope, we've got clear evidence of a lien on your vehicle, and it's gone, and we have it." Well, they towed it from another state. By that time, he was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which straddles Tennessee and Kentucky. He was in the Tennessee part, and I said, "Well, this is not only wrong, but it's probably illegal as well, because several people along the line failed to note that this lien was satisfied, and now they got to you and they're taking your car." He said, "I don't have any money to hire a lawyer. I just need my car back." So I called the Tennessee Attorney General and I called the Kentucky Attorney General and said, "What can you do about this?" And they said, "We don't have time to deal with these things. It sounds like it's just basically a dispute between this soldier and the title company, and he clearly probably did something wrong, so he's just going to have to deal with it and sue on his own." And my buddy was out of sorts. He said, "I have no car. I need my car to do my job for the Army that I have. I live off post, and I can't afford this." And I said, "Well, do they have anything like a private attorney general statute in the state of Tennessee?" And of course, they don't have anything like that there. And so I said, "Well, your only option is to hire a lawyer." He said, "Well, Lesh, can I hire you?" I said, "No, I'm not a member of the Tennessee Bar, and I can't help you in these areas anyway. I'm a criminal lawyer." He said, "Well, what am I supposed to do? It'll cost me more to hire a lawyer than it would for me to go buy a new car. I don't have money for either one." When I was an intern here under Andy Dawkins back in 1997, he had looked at this private attorney general statute, which is why I remembered it and was even able to tell him anything about it at the time. As it turned out, I employed the help of some other individuals down there and called in some favors and got people to make some phone calls, as well as I did too, but he was still not able to get his car back. This change would ensure that the courts do not have the option to look at that and say, "This looks like just a he said, she said. You better sue and try to get it figured out." Members, The statute that was passed in Minnesota, and this is a great example of why it's very important to be aware of what is said in committee and who is saying what in committee, because the court in 2000, in a case called Levy-Nystrom, stated that the private attorney general statute in Minnesota, which allowed a consumer to collect attorney fees in suing to vindicate their rights when the attorney general did not have the staff to do it, had to be applicable to everyone. It had to be essentially a class action where you can show that this company, say for in the Tennessee example, was towing 100 people's cars. You had to go out and find. You would have to go out and find all of these individuals to show a clear public purpose in that. Well, this was a policy of that company to do that, to just run roughshod and pick up people's cars without adequate determination of whether or not they were entitled to them. In Minnesota, the same thing is happening. And in 2000, under Levy-Nystrom, the Supreme Court stated no. They cited the record established in committee. In fact, it's cited on March 8, 1973, Senator Winston Borden, who is the author of the bill, stated in a hearing before the Labor and Commerce Committee that his goal was to allow the individual person to bring civil action for damages he sustained. It's a great means of private enforcement. It's simply impossible for the Attorney General's office to investigate and prosecute every act of consumer fraud in the state. And if an individual could bring an action, he can do some of the prosecuting, he can do some of the enforcing, he can provide some of the protection for himself and others that the Attorney General's office cannot do today. Now, on March 30th, a few weeks later, and Winston Borden, I didn't even know who the guy was. Apparently, I'm friends with him on Facebook. Is he your constituent?
Yeah.
Yeah, I see this guy, he does these prosy quotes about his farm-to-table stuff. And I'm like, well, he was the senator that passed this. What do you know? He lives up in northern Minnesota and eats goat cheese and things. Now, he sounds like a great guy. Now, great, the Supreme Court is going to be looking at my statements about him. Regardless, a few weeks later, Representative Sieben, whom most of you did not serve with his niece Katie, but who's now over in the Senate, he stated that this is a great opportunity for this statute, because the purpose of the private AG statute is to stop the unscrupulous businessman who makes false and deceptive ads, and with his adoption, a private citizen may take a person to court. Now, he also said, you can do this when a company is defrauding a lot of people. So the Supreme Court took his statements from legislative committee and said, well, clearly that was the legislative intent. Now, it was just one opportunity, but in 2000, the court turned that on its head and said no. In fact, in kind of modifying the statute, the court said that the statute in falling within the Consumer Fraud Act, it would turn into a statute where attorney's fees and additional costs would be awarded unjustly because to do so would substantially alter a fundamental principle of law deeply ingrained in our common law jurisprudence that each party bears his own attorney's fees in the absence of a statutory or contractual exception. Well, that's what we did. We provided the statutory exception. The legislature did that. The Supreme Court said, well, you need a statutory exception to do it. So we want to clarify the law here. There was some excellent dissent in this case, including Justice Page, who says that the court cannot do this. When the words of a statute are clear and free from ambiguity, we have no right to construe or interpret our statute's language. And likewise, it was a 4-3 decision in that case. So we're simply attempting to clarify the law. And I have with me, and Mr. Carlson told me your name, but
Charlie Berg.
It's Mr. Charlie Berg from Rochester, who is a better testifier than me on this.
Should I go ahead?
Sure, please.
I've never done this before, but consumer fraud is an issue that's really dear to my heart. I've been practicing law since 1973, and I still do consumer cases. I've tried a lot of consumer cases, and several of my cases have been through the appellate process, and a number of them have suffered through what we call adverse result as a result of Levy-Nystrom. And the interpretation of that decision by the federal courts in the state, which have basically virtually overridden the entire statute to the point that no consumers have have a right of action under 325F69 and Minnesota Statute 8.31. I'm a private attorney. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and so I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. The fundamental problem in civil litigation these days is the enormous expense associated with getting to court and staying into court with a well-heeled defendant. I think all of us understand that a person with a $5,000 case going against a corporation that may have defrauded them is never going to be able to hire a lawyer if they're a poor person. And they simply can't afford it, and those cases go by the board. Now, certainly they'd be able to bring a small court claims case, but if you expand it beyond the jurisdiction of the conciliation court, that case goes nowhere. The issue is one of leverage. And leverage in a situation where there's been a misrepresentation or some fraud on behalf of the seller of a product or a service. And this body decided in 1973 that the leverage was going to go with the consumer. The other aspect of this is that when you're dealing in issues in the marketplace, the unscrupulous seller, the one who deceives, has an edge, a competitive edge, over those who are righteous, who don't deceive customers. They get more of the market share because of their fraudulent conduct. The purpose of this, then, is to allow private consumers to act as what we call private attorney generals. The attorney general simply doesn't have the budget to enforce every consumer fraud action in this state. Empowering private citizens to act on their own behalf to make these people pay, the people who defraud the public, is right. It's just. It levels the playing field in almost all cases. The bulk of my practice, what I do, is for farmers. I do a lot of commercial litigation on behalf of dairy farmers in particular, arising out of products and services that are not properly advertised. There's misrepresentations associated with them. One example, people were selling heifer calves in southern Minnesota. This one farmer from Wisconsin was coming over here, leaving flyers, and selling female calves. Well, unknown to the farmers, and exactly contrary to the representation that was made, most of these calves are what they call free Martins. In other words, they were a female twin to a bull calf, which in about 90% of cases are sterile. So they're getting really what amounts to a beef animal, which they think is a female that's going to grow up and produce calves and milk. This is a situation where these farmers who work to a pretty close budget would not be able to afford a lawyer without the benefit of this statute. And the statute specifically permits an 8.31 subdivision 3A a right of private action to collect damages. In another farm case, which is the Kalmus versus J-Star case, which I pursued in federal court, the federal court judge in that case said the fact that this farmer, Mr. Kalmus, was suing for his own damages, which the statute specifically allows, augured against him being able to recover under 8.31, completely standing the current statute on its head. This is what's happened, and the benefit of this amendment is to make clear what I think is totally clear already, that a private person who's injured by violation of the consumer fraud statutes has a right of action under 8.31 and can collect their attorney's fees and expenses if they win, if they prove their case. Now, one of the things you may hear later from the other side of this is Justice Stringer's oft-quoted comment, which is, if we interpret the statute the way the plaintiffs in Lee v. Nystrom wanted to do it, that's going to make every dog bite case into a case where you can collect attorney's fees. Not so. dog bite case is a negligence action. It doesn't involve deceptive practices or fraud. This doesn't cover car accidents. It doesn't cover other negligent product liability cases where there is no fraud, there is no false advertising. We're talking about inducements that people rely upon for purchases of products and services. That is a specific subset of tort law that this legislature addressed many, many years ago, and I think the complete misinterpretation of that by the Supreme Court, but also more particularly the federal courts, needs to be undone. So actually, that's really all I have to say. If anybody's got any questions, I'm very familiar with the statute.
I apologize. Would you please restate your name? We didn't.
Charles Byrd, B-I-R-D.
Thank you.
If I could, I have another testifier with legal aid, Madam Chair. But before he comes up, I'd just like to note, in addition to Mr. Byrd's disabuse of the statement by Justice Stringer in 2000, remember, members, that you have to win first. This is not any encouragement of any frivolous lawsuits or opening the floodgates of otherwise worthless claims. You first have to win. After that, it comes down to whether or not you get attorney's fees, which is the only way anyone can ever avail themselves of the opportunity for justice in court anyway. And with that,
Representative Liebling, was your question to the previous witness?
I'll just, Madam Chair, it's sort of a general question, and maybe the next testifier could answer it too in his comments. And I just wondered if the Attorney General has the right to intervene in these cases. If this bill were to become law, well, I don't know how this works, but I'm just wondering if that would occur at some point. But if the testifier wants to just go ahead, maybe that'll be answered in the along the course of things here.
Well, I will, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, if the Attorney General were to intervene, you wouldn't need the private Attorney General statute, because then the Attorney General would be prosecuting the fraud or whatever it is they have the opportunity to do. So the opportunity is there.
Madam Chair. President Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesch, I guess I'm not saying that as a way to say we don't need to do this. I'm just thinking, you know, sometimes once something's in process, the Attorney General might go, aha, you know, now our consciousness is raised, now we see this is an important issue. And I'm just wondering if there would be an opportunity, or if they could come in and you know, not every a person might do this pro se, or even if they get an attorney, that attorney might not be the best attorney, and there might need to be some additional help at some point to carry some of these things forward. I'm just wondering what the dynamics of it are.
They are, and in Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, in Levy Nystrom, they did participate. Prentice Cox at the time participated in that case. It was originally a private action, so they joined it. Similar to me, I mean, I'm never usually a Vikings fan until they start winning either. So I expect the Attorney General to get on board when someone else starts winning.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I was going to say I'm just going to make 3 points, but Representative Lesch took the third one, so now it'll only be 2 points. I just want to point out that nothing in the original legislation indicated or even implied that any additional hurdles or burdens had to be met by a plaintiff trying to seek relief for a fraud committed against the plaintiff. So there was nothing that required any additional hurdle. And the effect of this, really, I mean, in just everyday life, is that the effect is that the courthouse door really has been barred to the individual person, which seems to be contrary to everything that our system supports. And the other comment I'd just like to make in support of this bill is that, you know, this statute's had been in effect before this Levy-Nystrom case for quite some time, I think nearly 30 years. And no one, to my knowledge, had come up to you at the legislature, your predecessors, to ask for a repeal or even an amendment. So I think what that's indicative of is that this had never been, you know, an invitation for litigation abuse. The concerns that we often hear expressed and, you know, in some cases, you know, certainly maybe legitimately, you know, about uncertainty and liability for our business community, which would impact prices and all that, that just did not materialize. I mean, the statute had been in effect for quite a long time, and nobody seemed to really have any problems with it. And so I would urge you to seriously consider passing this bill on and fixing a problem that really was imposed upon consumers by the court and contrary to the very, very fundamental premise of the original legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, I've been actually a victim of fraud twice in my life here, and probably more than that, but I'm just a trusting person. But in one time it was picked up by the Attorney General, and I got nothing out of it, but yeah, they went after the folks. The other one, I actually was able to take it to the county sheriff who investigated. We criminally prosecuted and got restitution. Explain to me, because one, I was successful in getting restitution through a criminal prosecution of fraud and worked through the county attorney to get that taken care of. And one, I went through the Attorney General and got prosecution and got nothing out of it. What is this going to benefit, and what does this help in that situation? I guess if somebody commits fraud, we should be able to go through the criminal and get that. Is this just over punitive damages and getting a dollar in my back pocket? Or explain to me how that works.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, for one thing, no, it's not about punitive damages. Punitive damages are extremely difficult to get in Minnesota and very rarely awarded. And I think Mr. Carlson could cite the number of times punitive damages have been awarded in the state of Minnesota, and it's essentially almost never. We're just talking actual damages here. I absolutely agree. Some of these should be criminally prosecuted. They are violations of law, and they are crimes. Fraud is a crime. If you talk to the county attorneys, and I don't know if the county attorney is still here. They're here for the other bill, but it's really, really difficult. I'm impressed that you got a criminal prosecution for fraud because, number one, you have to show actual knowledge in criminal fraud. And then number two, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. And as a criminal law prosecutor, I know in many cases all the evidence that I need to get to establish that standard, and it's really tough. So this is the civil side where we're trying to wage that, where the burden is preponderance of evidence and allows for the consumer a better opportunity. Now, in that case where it was civilly done, thankfully by the help of the Attorney General, and you got nothing out of it, that's unfortunate because you put time, effort, and energy into that. At the same time, the point of the allotted jurisdiction of the Attorney General, and by extension, the jurisdiction of the private attorney general statute, is to deter that kind of conduct from other people. Word gets around. And when that individual was held accountable for what he or she did against you, word gets around and fewer people do it. That's my pitch.
Representative Simon.
thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howe, I actually was with the Attorney General's office in the Consumer and Antitrust Division when this case came down. And actually the person, by sheer coincidence, he's not even here to testify on this bill. But the person who argued the case for the state is sitting behind us, Prentice Cox. He's here for another bill. But I my guess is, Representative Howe, I don't know your situation. I don't know if it was a one-off kind of one-on-one transaction of some kind, but that's the very idea of this bill. I'm guessing without knowing that the Attorney General was handcuffed to some extent because it was a one-off transaction. It might have been, and that you can't get to that public benefit or standard unless it was kind of a broader fraud than that. I don't know your circumstance, and you didn't say, and you don't have to say. But the point is, this opens it up so that it's not that the one-on-one transaction that's deceptive or fraudulent of some kind would now be actionable by an individual. I don't know the circumstances of your case, and I'd be interested to see if Mr. Cox, my former colleague at the Attorney General's office, who argued the Levy-Nystrom case, might have something to say about that. I don't want to hijack your bill, Mr. Chair, but this guy is the authority and has written law review articles about the very case.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's a great idea. He's willing to talk about it. He wasn't. I didn't give him a heads up and prepare him, but since he argued the case 12, 13 years ago, I'm sure he remembers enough.
Mr. Cox.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I actually... I didn't argue the case. I just filed an amicus brief for the state in that case.
Oh, wow.
So, a little history on that. The issue was never presented in the form that the Supreme Court decided in 2000. In other words, no one ever got to argue about whether we should have the public benefit test in the form it was presented. The court just announced that. And how you get there from the language of the statute remains more than 10 years after the fact, an utter mystery to me. And I give it to law students and say, where's the ambiguity? How do you get there? And they just open their mouths and go, oh. I say, well, see, this is an example. I did a study in 2006. I just want to note, my research assistant for the study is sitting next to the, is sitting up there, who's your staff person at the time. And the result of that was, and it's pretty clear since then, individuals and family farmers cannot bring an action, a private right of action. And I have no idea why we would want that result from creation of the private right of action. Basically, it allows joinder and class action cases and eliminates any cases by individuals and family farmers. And family farmers are actually, lawyers for family farmers are one of the most active users of this statute in many cases and can no longer bring those cases. I think the need to overturn this result is clear, not just because it's the right policy, but also because the legislature needs to send a message to the court. When a statute is as utterly unambiguous as that statute, you simply can't rewrite it to reach a result that might better fit the predilections of the court at the time the decision was made. And I use those words very advisedly. I wouldn't say this normally. I still find this decision shocking after all these years. So thanks for the opportunity. Did I go off on a tangent? Please let me know.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. And we have public testimony about, first of all, Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for stepping up to fill us in there. And I think you said it pretty well, that, you know, a lot of times around here we hear about, and in the public we hear about people complaining about so-called activist judges, and judges shouldn't make the law, they should apply the law. And it sounds like this is one of those instances where somebody might want to say that the judge, the court, made law when they should have been interpreting law.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Lesch.
I could. Justice Page, in his dissent, essentially said that, made clear, citing by court decision, that the court just made this up.
And I believe we're going to hear Representative Mahler's bill, but we have a few more questions. Representative Howe?
Well, I I'm not an attorney, and I don't, but to respond to Representative Simon's question there is that the first case that went to the Attorney General was a multi-state, multi-individual mail fraud incident, and being totally dissatisfied with the outcome of getting zero from that, when the next one happened to me, and I went to the county, we actually investigated him on a multiple, and that happened to do with a number of businesses, a number of consumers, and we were able to prove that he had willful knowledge, and we got prosecution, and I got restitution. Much more satisfaction in that realm, because that person actually went to prison. I got a judgment for restitution. I didn't, but it was much more satisfying that way than the first way, where I got, I didn't even get a warm handshake on that deal. So, thank you,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a hypothetical here: if I want to go out and buy a business, and during my due diligence period, maybe I don't do the due diligence maybe that I should have, and later I find out that the seller of that business wasn't completely honest in the books that they turned over to me. And I go to sue, why, in an instance like that, where would the public have any interest in that?
Well, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. You are citing the example of Levy Nystrom. In that case, the individual purchaser of a business, the business which was held out to be lucrative and turning over a strong profit, established that it was later on established that the buyer was completely duped. He was an unsophisticated operator. He did not speak a lot of English. He came to this country 10 years prior and worked in different restaurants and tried to buy a restaurant. It was held out that the revenue stream the restaurant he was buying would more than satisfy the purchase price that he made. It was told to be completely false, and the statements that were made, those are questions of fact for a jury. In order to get those questions of fact before a jury, you have to have access to the courthouse. And without any option, in order to get fees out of it, there's no attorney who's going to represent you to give you access to a courthouse. If it turns out that the issue was caveat emptor, the person should absolutely have done their due diligence, then the jury of your peers can decide, you know what, you just didn't do enough. The average person would have done it. The case gets thrown out, and there is no attorney fees awarded. I think that's the safeguard against the situation you described.
Representative Scott.
Well, I don't see where that's a public interest. And to me, that's a one-on-one transaction. And a public interest to me means that more than one person is harmed, you know, that many people may be harmed. And maybe I've got that wrong, but I just don't see why. I think that this would just flood the courts. I think it would just flood the courts with people coming forward. And what's the drawing line for everybody that doesn't do their due diligence to start flooding into court and creating all kinds of frivolous lawsuits, well, when they haven't done their part?
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, this does not cover every case. As was stated previously, this does not cover every dog bite. This does not cover breach of contracts. It only covers those areas of jurisdiction over which the Attorney General has authority. And we've given the Attorney General authority over certain areas that are in the public interest. So this only applies to those cases where we said, hey, Attorney General, there's certain areas of law here that are just wrong. And for someone to perpetrate this upon a consumer, you have authority to prosecute these civil actions. So, no, it won't. I mean, the Attorney General already has the authority to do it, but there are so many wrongs perpetrated on consumers, you want to give them their own opportunities to do it. We're not inventing any new causes of action. We're simply giving the average consumer access to the courts the same way they would if the Attorney General was adequately staffed to handle them.
Representative Scott.
Well, if I wanted to bring a cause of action against the person that didn't give me the right information when I'm buying a business, I can do that. I have access to the court now.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, not if you can't get an attorney to take your case. You don't. Attorneys will typically get cases on contingency, or they'll do an hourly rate. And if you're a person who all of a sudden is up to your ears in credit debt because someone defrauded you on the business, where are you going to get money for a retainer to buy a lawyer, to get it to retain a lawyer? You just can't do it. That's not access to the courts. If they have some reasonable opportunity to get attorney's fees, they look at your case and say, yeah, it's clear cut, and I can't get paid now, but I've got access to the 8.31 statute, the attorney represents you. That's access to the courts.
And members, in consideration of time, we'll have Representative Mollery come up and present his bill. Representative Mollery.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Basically, this is an issue I've been working on ever since I heard of the decision in Levy Nystrom. and eventually put in a bill. I actually have handled consumer fraud cases, and it was an incredible shock hearing the Levy-Nystrom decision. In fact, one of my friends signed the terrible decision, or didn't sign it, but joined in, and as soon as he retires, he'll get an earful. But basically, I couldn't get a hearing on this until this year, and before that, I was told by the governor's office that it was DOA, so wasn't much reason to pursue it, but it's been pretty much put forward. It's a really simple issue. The statute says that if you, and it says any person, very clearly any person, that's not, you don't have to have a bunch of people for any. And I wanted to go through a little bit about the background on this, a little more thorough, and what an absurdity we have in the law here in Minnesota right now. If you really go back, Republicans were the first ones that started in on this. The Consumer Fraud Act was passed under the Republicans in the 1960s, I believe it was 1963, to get at this problem. And then in 1973, the Democrats, I believe, had become in power at the time, and they passed the Private Attorney General statute, which connected the two, so that when there was the consumer fraud, an attorney representing any party to that one-on-one transaction could bring a lawsuit and could recover attorney's fees so that they could bring a lawsuit. And the reason for that was because people weren't able to afford an attorney. Most consumer cases, there's not huge recoveries, and if they don't get attorney's fees, people just don't bring them. And so people were being shut out, and consumer fraud was allowed to run wild. So it was basically at that time that it was decided to protect consumers by doing from harm, so that they could pursue the perpetrator of the fraud and the victim could actually recover something. The statute says any injured person may sue, and all courts in Minnesota interpreted the law exactly as it stated any person. I never had a judge at any time question that one-on-one transactions were applicable, and that went on for 27 years. There was no problem. Many cases in Minnesota, many, many cases, never heard of the idea that it wouldn't apply to one-on-one transactions. And there wasn't any widespread, the you know, sky is falling type of thing that you're going to hear from certain people. That just didn't happen. I know I was involved. Richard Fuller, who is one of my witnesses, I know he's handled, I don't know where he is. Oh, he's still sitting over there. he's handled vast numbers of cases. And so suddenly in 2000, the court issued one of its worst opinions in history, Levy-Nystrom. They said that the court, that since the legislator included the right to get damages in the private attorney general statute, the victim could only get attorney's fees if the lawsuit was of, quotes, benefit to the public. Now, as Representative Lesch said, Representative Page wrote a scathing dissenting opinion. Even more scathing was the dissenting opinion by Justice Gilbert in there, in that case. They went on to indicate a one-on-one transaction was not a benefit to the public, basically. And they effectively reversed all the firmware court decisions in Minnesota. Then the Minnesota court issued another decision which let a business sue another consumer under the consumer fraud statute and collect attorney's fees. So our court has created probably the most bizarre situation in the country, whereby a consumer can't sue a business under the Consumer Fraud Act and receive a reasonable attorney's fees, but a business can sue another business on a one-on-one transaction under our Consumer Fraud Act and recover attorney's fees. I think that's an embarrassment for Minnesota, actually. You don't even, we often joke about the court decisions down in Mississippi and Alabama, et cetera, but I don't think they've ever issued anything creating such absurdity. Another issue that's an absurdity is that the case of Levy Nystrom, in the opinion, they cite two cases that they relied on. One was from Washington, and one was from Illinois. And the author of that opinion was either so sloppy or misleading that they didn't mention that the Illinois decision that they cited had already been overruled by the Illinois legislature, so it was no longer in effect. They also didn't mention that the basis for the Washington court decision, which had been 20 years earlier, maybe 24 years earlier, I can't remember, had already, the basis for that decision had been rescinded by the Washington court in its own later cases. So you had a decision that, first of all, was clearly contrary to the verbatim language of the statute. It was based on two misinterpretations of cases in other states. You can't get more absurd than when you look at this whole issue. Now, there were some other courts around the country, and I haven't researched this for a couple years, but there were some other cases about that time that a court issued an opinion somewhat like the Minnesota court in Levy Nystrom. And in all those cases, except one or two, I believe it is, nationally, other than Minnesota, Minnesota's still going by it, I believe there's only one or two states now that haven't either reversed it by a later court decision or by the legislature overruling the court decision, which is what we're asking here. As was stated, there's no question that the Attorney General can bring a consumer fraud case in Minnesota on a one-to-one situation. So we have another absurdity. The AG can sue on a one-to-one transaction, but the victim can't sue under the statute, which was created to help the Attorney General protect each consumer, and that statute specifically authorizes such a lawsuit. The practical effect of our present situation is businesses in Minnesota can commit fraud against consumers with little or no fear of being sued, because in most consumer cases, the consumer's attorney fees will eat up a large part of the award or all of it. I just want to review quickly the present situation's absurdities. Number one, a consumer in Minnesota can't sue a business for consumer fraud on a one-to-one transaction, but a business can use the consumer fraud statute to sue another business for consumer fraud and receive attorney's fees. Number two, the Attorney General can sue a business for consumer fraud in a one-to-one transaction and collect money for its attorney's fees, but the victim can't sue the perpetrator and get its fees, even though the same statute says the victim can do so. Three, we are one of a few states that don't protect consumers. And four, the court decision we are crushed under was based on a misreading of two other states' court decisions. I asked you to straighten out this mess we had created by one court decision.
Thank you, Representative Molloy. At this point, I'm going to move Representative Molloy's A1 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry. At this point, I'm going to move the...
Okay. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, did you move it yet?
She did.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Briefly, what this amendment does is...
Representative Molloy?
Oh.
Okay. We have public testimony as well. We'll figure this out, and then we have members of the public that are here to testify?
Before the amendment?
Madam Chair, isn't it the Lesh bill that's on the table? How can we be amending Molloy's
yes.
bill?
Right. Thank you, Representative.
Oh. Do I explain the amendment then?
Public testimony at this point.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And we have Kate Johannesson. Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, we've spent about 45 minutes on the pro side of this. We have less than a half hour left in committee time, plus another bill. I'm just wondering, time-wise, what the plan is here.
Okay, my understanding, the plan here is that we're going to hear this, the opposition, the testimony, and that we will then, and then if time allows, we will take a vote at that time. If time allows, we'll hear the next bill, and then we'll recess and reconvene so that there's sufficient time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mueller.
We have one witness who probably handled more consumer cases than anybody in the state, I'm guessing. He was supposed to testify. Is he not get time then? Or
let's start with the opposition testimony first. Representative Mueller. Ms. Johannesson.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and it's 2,400 employer members, 80% of which are smaller businesses. And we'd like to thank you for the opportunity today to testify in House Files 54 and 642. The Chamber opposes this legislation for a few simple reasons, and I'll try to keep my testimony brief so that everyone has the opportunity to speak. But basically, those reasons fall into a couple of categories, and the first relate to background itself. Certainly, the previous testifiers have established a sound basis of understanding that this problem, proposed legislation comes out of the Livy Nystrom case. And there are two issues here that I think that are necessary to bring to the committee's attention. First, whether you agree with the case or not, it is the law of the land. This is what the Supreme Court has interpreted this statute to be. And so first, you would be overturning Supreme Court precedent. And certainly no one needs to tell this committee or the legislature that that degree of scrutiny requires extreme conscientiousness when you're deciding to conflict with an existing Supreme Court decision. And the Supreme Court in this case made very clear that this statute should not apply to one-on-one transactions. That is very evidently what the court stated. And the second concern here with respect to the case's background is that we are abrogating through this legislation a very basic common law principle, which is that parties pay for their own attorney's fees. And that's deeply ingrained in American jurisprudence. I think that the quotation that Representative Lesch read earlier today is so important that I'm going to read it very quickly again, just to fully in context, because it shows the policy reasons for why extending this legislation would be a poor idea. And the court said, we find further support for our holding that public interest must be demonstrated to a state claim under the private attorney general statute based on our conclusion that the legislature could not have intended to sweep every private dispute based on fraud and falling within the CFA into a statute where attorney fees and additional costs and expenses would be awarded, because to do so would substantially alter a fundamental principle of law deeply ingrained in our common law jurisprudence that each party bears his own attorney fees in the absence of a statutory or contractual exception. So first, please just note that this is overturning precedent, whether you agree with it or not, and that there are sound common law principles that underscore the decision. But there are also policy arguments that I'd like to bring to your committee's attention in why we oppose the legislation. And the first simply is that this will lead to increased litigation. It applies to any potential sale. It applies to real estate. It applies to auto dealers. Every small business that sells a product could potentially face a lawsuit under this. The scope is nearly unlimited. And that will increase frivolous lawsuits. It's sad to say, but it is simply the truth. The second point is that litigation isn't free. This will cost small businesses a lot of money. And someone always pays for that litigation. Here it could be individuals, it could be small businesses, and it will definitely be consumers, because those costs will be passed along. They don't evaporate just because a party wins or loses. Certainly, we're sympathetic to the idea that you have to win to be afforded ultimately damages or a reward. But at the same time, while consumers might say that they have problems accessing the court, businesses have problems defending these. They don't have any source of attorney's fees for defending these actions. And I would just say that, you know, Joe's Garage doesn't have the resources to defend against multiple frivolous lawsuits any more than anybody else has the resources to bring them. We've seen this demonstrated in other states, which is the fifth point that I'd like to raise. This has not been a successful endeavor in other states. In California, for example, the state actually saw so much abuse under this type of legislation that it used its initiative and referendum power to curtail the statute because they were seeing frivolous lawsuits that were damaging to the state's judicial climate. And also, there's an infamous case out of the District of Washington, D.C., where a dry cleaner, a small mom-and-pop dry cleaner, actually went out of business defending a suit. Ultimately, the plaintiff in that case lost, but the dry cleaner still went out of business because they simply didn't have the money to defend this type of litigation. And ultimately, I just want to underscore the point that there are other options, and I think Representative Howe's point underscores that. And certainly, the appropriate cause of action in a one-on-one fraud case is a fraud suit. It is the existing cause of action. Or, if it's a criminal matter, I would say that it's appropriate to take that action, as Representative Howe did, to your local criminal prosecutor, rather than relying on this type of civil case. So with that, I'd conclude my testimony, and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. President. Next testifier is Chris Friends. Mr. Renz.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Chris Renz. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Thompson & Nybeck. We represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, which is also a member of the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. We are opposing House File 642 and the House File 54 respectfully on three grounds. One, it's unnecessary. Two, it's harmful to realtors and other small businesses. And three, it's inherently unfair. As to the unnecessary, this is a solution for a problem that doesn't exist. Under the current state of the law, judges can, and they do in fact, determine when a case is in the public interest. And when it's in the public interest, they award attorney's fees. I point the committee to the case of Collins versus Minnesota School of Business, in which the court did just that. So it's not as though this doesn't occur. Minnesota Supreme Court has already closely examined this, as the court's well aware from previous testimony. There was some suggestion that the public benefit burden makes this a requirement that there be a class action status, that there be so many people hurt that it would qualify for the private attorney general statute. That's not what's required. The public benefit interest has to do primarily with to whom the representations or misrepresentations were made and by how many or to how many people. The statute, as its title suggests, allows a private citizen to stand in the shoes of the Attorney General's office in certain instances. Just as there wouldn't be direct out-of-pocket costs for the Attorney General to pursue it, the statute affords the private citizen attorney's fees. But in that same light, the Attorney General doesn't pursue private interests. I'd point the committee to Minnesota Statute 801. The Attorney General appears in civil cases where, quote, the interests of the state require it. This House file expands this beyond the interests of the state. It expands it to private interests. That's what's being sought here, and I don't think it's appropriate under the current statute. The claimants already have redress. If there's public benefit, that is, if the misrepresentations were made to more than one person, they qualify for attorney's fees under Lee versus Nystrom. If it's not a public benefit, they have the private causes of action. The prior testifier talked about that. And third, if it's a criminal matter, then there's the proper prosecuting authority as highlighted by Representative Howe. So first, it's unnecessary. Secondly, the proposed law creates problems for both realtors and other small businesses. I've litigated cases against real estate agents and brokers on both sides of that equation for over a decade in this state, and I can tell you that there is already a sentiment of sue every realtor involved in any aspect of the transaction because there's a belief that that will bring insurance proceeds to the table. With this law, with this House file, that puts even more blood in the water. Realtors are already, and other small businesses, put in a position of paying money to settle unfounded lawsuits in order to avoid the costs of their own litigation going forward, defending against that litigation. This House file exacerbates that problem. misguided plaintiffs and plaintiffs' attorneys are bringing suit against everybody involved with the allure of attorney's fees. There was the California example cited by the previous testifier, and that's exactly what would happen here. Contingency fee attorneys bringing nuisance action after nuisance action, knowing money will be offered to settle due to the risk of attorney's fees on top of the cost of litigation. There's been some suggestion here that, well, you have to win. So it's only those claims that there's actually something behind it that this bill affects. It's not. That ignores what is actually going on in the courts. Cases don't go to trial. Civil suits don't go to trial. It's a matter of leverage. One of the testifiers on the other side already talked about this. What you're doing is you're giving undue leverage to the claimant. And so now they have a bully club where, upon bringing frivolous litigation, they're forcing the defendant to their knees in settlement, because not only is that person facing the possibility of damages, their own attorney's fees to defend even a frivolous claim, but now the attorney's fees of the other side. And to the extent that this committee is under the impression that, well, that's not a big deal for people like realtors because they're insured, I would point out that under most insurance policies for errors and omissions for realtors and other professionals, this is an exception. In other words, this will affect individuals. This will affect your constituents that are small businesses. They will end up having to pay this out of their own pocket. So this bill has negative effects on individuals. So the second reason that we oppose this is that it's going to be harmful to realtors and other small businesses. And the third is that this house file is inherently unfair. This has all upside for claimant. This has all upside for the nuisance litigant. They recover their fees if they win, but there is no downside if they lose. They are not required to pay the fees of the realtor. They're not required to pay the fees of the small business if they brought a bad claim and they lose. It only stands to incentivize weak and frivolous claims on already a strained judicial system. As Ms. Johansson pointed out, the default is the American rule. People pay their own freight. Each side pays their own fees and costs. This wants to give one side the advantage. You're giving a knife to only one fighter in the fist fight, and that doesn't level the playing field. That's what's being held out here, that this somehow levels the playing field. It does not. This David and Goliath scenario that's been painted may be true in certain instances, but these are small businesses and individuals that my firm represents that defend against what are often frivolous claims. And now the other side gets a weapon that the people we represent don't have. It's unfair. It's the inequity of this unbalanced bill that's going to create negative consequences to realtors that I just described. If you want to consider a bill that's fair, then allow loser pays. All right? Allow a system where if you bring a frivolous claim, then the American then you are the one paying the fees for the other side that had to defend against that frivolous claim. But that's not what this does. This gives only the advantage to the claimant. It's going to create an atmosphere of attorney's fees, and by passing it, you're ignoring the crippling effect of nuisance suits against what are often very small businesses and individuals, especially our constituents that are in the real estate industry. I would also ask that the court look carefully at the amendment by Representative Mollery in House File 54, because it goes beyond Representative Lesch's amendment and includes such a string of claims that fall under this attorney's fees provision if the whole thing is adopted that there's almost nothing that even comes close to touching fraud, which wouldn't be argued as having attorney's fees. So for all those reasons, committee, we respectfully ask that you not pass this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Renz.
Thank you.
Just a brief comment. You know, when we hear testimony that says things that are factually untrue, I think that there needs to be some rebuttal of some kind. And the fact is there's a statute, Minnesota Statute 549.21, that allows a judge to assess attorney's fees and penalties against any frivolous litigant. So it's not true that people can just bring frivolous lawsuits with no penalty and muck up the courts and waste people's time. There is a remedy. The judges have that ability to sanction people. It happens. And so I just thought that needed to be on the record.
Thank you. Bob Johnson is next testifier. Representative Simon.
Quickly, as the next testifier is coming down, a couple of things. I'm told I know it's always great to use California as an example without context. It sounds like crazy, kooky, chaotic California. 45 states have the law as this bill would make it. 45. We are the outlier. So it's not just California. It's Oklahoma and Arkansas and it's conservative states, it's liberal states, it's 45 states have what this bill seeks. We are the outlier. Secondly, when it comes to leverage and settlements, which I've experienced myself in civil law, another set of good leverage is good facts. So a lot of times when you hear about settlements, the idea that people are brought to their knees by greedy plaintiff's attorney, sometimes it's because someone did something wrong, or at least a jury might conclude that someone did something wrong. So another thing when you're going to a negotiation that gives defendants in any lawsuit leverage is actually having facts that are on their side. When they're not on their side, sometimes but not always, there's a settlement. And that's just that's life in litigation.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'll be extraordinarily brief because I won't repeat any of the comments of previous two opponents. I support and agree what they commented. And it's Bob Johnson. I'm with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm also on the board of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. Just briefly, Madam Chair and committee members, that what this will open up, and I just want everyone to be aware of it, is the Minnesota courts struggle with, and there is a lot of litigation in the trial and appellate courts about what are the appropriate billing judgments of lawyers in these fee-shifting statutes. So we're going to wrestle with those issues in this context, and here's why it's important. And I was just reading a brief of it's before the Minnesota Supreme Court of Marie Dolores Green versus BMW of North America, a recent case. And I don't even know if it's decided, but one of the briefed issues there, and it's in a fee-shifting statute, and it specifically deals with in the debate about the overreaching billing practices of the plaintiffs in that case, where the plaintiff is billing differently under the fee-shifting statute as opposed to what that plaintiff would be billing if the client were paying the dollars. So in other words, what the Minnesota courts, and there are a lot of decisions that you can look at where the courts are wrestling with, and there's not clear direction. This statute, this bill, if it's adopted, certainly doesn't change that dilemma of making a determination of the appropriate billing judgment of the lawyer, because frankly what it comes down to, and this is a case where there was a considerable amount of billing by the plaintiff, and it's because it's a fee-shifting statute, for kind of the standard practices in a law firm using the boilerplate summons, complaint, interrogatories, and the lawyers were billing a lot of hours for kind of standard work that didn't necessitate a lot of hours of billing. And I've just, so the committee is aware, I mean, that issue is before our trial and appellate courts because there isn't guidance in terms of what's the appropriate billing judgment of lawyers. And I believe that, again, what this bill is going to do is open up a situation that, frankly, I don't think is fair or right. A lawyer shouldn't be billing differently because it's a fee-shifting statute as opposed to how that lawyer would bill it if the client were paying for the same work. And that's just happening. It's happening. You can read the Green versus BMW case, and these are cases, lastly, Madam Chair and committee members, that you end up seeing the attorney's fees. This is a case where the attorney's fees is over 10 times the amount of the money that the plaintiff is going to recover. So you have large multiples of the attorney fee recovery as opposed to what the plaintiff is actually getting in the case. That's what happens in fee-shifting statutes. So, Madam Chair, it happens in fee-shifting statutes. So, Madam Chair and committee members, I just wanted to add that to the debate. It is part of what's going to come out of if House File 642 or 54, whichever the bill moves forward and is passed into law. So thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Simon.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, and I've represented both plaintiffs and defendants, so I've been on both sides of this issue. When there's an attorney fee case, if you've ever been involved with one or seen, well, it's almost like a lawsuit after the lawsuit. There is an extensive, almost excruciating argument that goes on, motion after motion, about what is the proper level of attorney's fees. And judges freely and constantly and all the time are saying, I'm not giving you that. It's not like plaintiff's lawyers in an attorney fee shifting case present a bill and the judge just sort of stamps it. There are hours. I want those dozens of hours of my life back, I can tell you. Arguing over, did you really need two lawyers at that hearing? Or how come you made so many copies? Or how come this motion took you 12 hours? I'm only going to give you enough credit for 7 or 5 or 4 or 3. The idea, the suggestion, at least implicit in the testimony we just heard, was that a plaintiff just presents a bill and that's it. I can tell you I want those hours of my life back because those are huge fights in these cases. It is not the case that and if people are overbilling at rates that they wouldn't ordinarily, a judge is going to smack them every time. That's my experience.
Members?
Oh. Madam Chair.
Any more questions? Representative Howe.
And I apologize because I stepped out for a moment, but one of the questions I have is looking at 325, it talks about the misleading statements, and it seems like that's pretty broad. What's the difference between a misleading statement and a misstatement that we all make every once in a while? What's the difference between a misstatement and a misleading statement and a misrepresentation?
Representative
Madam Chair, Representative Howell, the answer to that question lies squarely in the province of the finder of fact, namely the jury. You can establish to a jury beyond a preponderance of the evidence that it was deliberately misleading, and they can find, unless they can find some reason that it doesn't pass the burden that it was simply a misstatement, then that is the fact that the jury finds. But that is a fact in a laundry list of items that they must find in order to establish that fraud was committed.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you. My question was for the representative from the Realtors Association.
Mr. Renz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, in your testimony, you referenced a case, Collins versus Minnesota School of Business, and I'm not sure I understood the nuances of the points you were making. So if you could clarify what that case was about and why it's an example of not needing this legislation.
Mr. Renz.
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding of that case is probably not as detailed as it should be. It did have to do with a local school, a college, that had made some representations to the public at large. And as a result, because it had made the misrepresentations to more than one people, more than one person about its offerings, there was a claim brought by one of, I believe, an applicant who brought a claim, and it went up to the Supreme Court, and they found that, yes, it did meet the public benefit requirement. And the reason I raised it in my remarks was that it sounded like the public benefit test was something that was an impossible hurdle, and there were all these cases being swept under the rug. I hold it out as an example of the fact that that's not true. It can be met, and it's met where there are misrepresentations made to more than one person.
Great, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, Representative Mullery, this question is for both of you. First little comment. I see that this bill is going to really backlog the court system with a number of cases going into the court systems, and being on the judiciary, hearing, talking to the judges, they already have a large backlog of cases already. In fact, one of my constituents has been waiting over 14 and 16 months just to hear a custody issue with his son. And the case keeps getting postponed because of the backlog in the court system with other more important cases. I see a need. Have either one of you requested a fiscal note on that for the court system because of the huge backlog in the cost to the courts? And not only just for the state level, also the extra costs for the counties that run the courts?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, this bill does not create a new cause of action. I have not requested a fiscal note. I will have conversation with Representative Hillstrom about that. Although I would note, Representative Johnson, I first started serving down here in 2003. And the hue and cry that I heard a lot of was the recent massive increase of frivolous lawsuits. Ironically, we had 27 years of this law that I'm trying to pass now apply from 1973 to 2000. Within 3 years of this decision being handed down, where that was no longer the case, I got elected and people were talking about increased frivolous lawsuits. So I'm not so certain that it would lead to any increase in light of the fact that there was discussion of increase in the wake of the Lee decision.
Well, Madam Chair, also.
Representative Meyer.
It hasn't been brought out how hard it is to get one. Bringing a frivolous lawsuit doesn't mean anything because it's really hard to prove this. I remember one case I had I had the defense counsel asked for 9 special interrogatories to be answered by the in addition to the general verdict I got, they asked for 9 special interrogatories, and every one had to be answered yes by the jury. And the defense counsel could write every single interrogatory that they wanted in that courtroom. So you have a huge amount to overcome because your run-of-the-mill case, you're just not going to be able to convince the jury of all these special characteristics that are in here.
Representative, do you have a follow-up question, Representative Johnson?
Just a comment to Ms. Representative Mullery with what you just stated, but it's already taking the court costs because you're already in the court system. So there is going to be costs. With you, to make your point where it's, you had to answer all these questions with the jury and stuff, at that point you're in the court systems where it's going to cost costs.
And Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lash, I just need to follow up on a statement that you made about this not, in fact, bringing any extra, you know, costs to bear on the courts. You know, just respectfully disagree. You know, we sit on the Judiciary Committee together, and we've heard one court presentation after the next about how the courts are, in fact, backlogged. And I just do think that we've become a much more litigious society, it would appear, since potentially 2003. So that's just the comment that I would make.
And members, this will be going to Commerce. At this time, and to Judiciary. At this time, I'll renew House File 642, be recommended pass, and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor,
Chair,
say aye.
Madam Chair.
Aye.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh. I mean, Representative Scott.
I'd like to have a roll call on this, please.
Roll call being called. And the clerk will take the roll.
Lesh.
Aye.
Ellen.
Aye.
Scott.
No.
Anderson.
No.
Hillstrom. Colbert.
No.
Portman.
Definitely yes.
Powell.
That counts as 2.
No. Johnson.
No.
Liebling.
Yes.
Neuberger.
No.
Paymar.
Aye.
Pugh.
No.
Rosenthal.
Aye.
Simon.
Yes.
Yaruso.
Aye.
On a vote 8-7, the motion is carried. And Representative Mullery, you have an amendment that...
Yes, Madam Chair. A1.
First, I'll move your bill.
Okay, thank you. I didn't
count. House File 54, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Commerce. Yeah. And then your amendment, I'll move your A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape
thank
you would
you,
like.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are we going to discuss the amendment? If you could tell us what that does, Representative Mullery?
Yes.
It has to be moved before we discuss it.
Representative Mullery,
thank you, Madam Chair. The first one is really simple. It's funny that nobody ever looked at it before, but three, if you look at 801, which is the Attorney General statute, under subdivision 3, it talks about specific things that they can get an injunction against actions. After one of if the Attorney General, in other words, brings this lawsuit, they can get an injunction against further action, and they can also recover damages for the state, or not damages, but penalties for this, which would go to the state general fund. And they do that regularly. And so all my amendment would do would be allow the court, if it wants to, it already says other equitable relief as determined by the court. The court could allow either an injunction against that act that they found to be consumer fraud, or they could assess the penalty, which would go to the state general fund.
Representative Mulley, can you wrap it up and be brief on this? People generally understand it,
okay.
I think.
I'll just, the second part is just bringing in the same exact language that's in the first sentence of subdivision 1 of the additional duties of the unfair, discriminatory, and unlawful is just bringing into the consumer fraud the same thing that it says the Attorney General statute is for. So that's the only reason that was there.
All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Questions?
No. Are you going to ask for testimony on this, or?
He had talked about it. What's that? It's just moving the bill in the shape to get the author so desires. All in favor?
To adopt an amendment? I mean, and have discussion over it?
It's what we're doing now, Representative Scott. We're getting the bill in the shape the author so desires. We do that all the time. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Okay, now we're on the bill as amended. Representative Mulley had explained that. I would note for individuals who are here on House File 83, we will be reconvening this evening at 7 o'clock. So my apologies for this going long. But that's what will be happening, and we will not be taking testimony because there's another committee in here at 10 o'clock. Now, Representative Mullery, are there questions members have for Representative Mullery on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, I'm
Representative Hobart.
I don't know that we're past our time, but generally you would allow people to testify on new language, but maybe we're not doing that.
We had testimony on that, Representative Holberg. That's why we presented together and then had the vote separately. There were two testifiers in opposition specifically to the amendment offered by Representative Mullery at the time. They just said that they really don't like my bill and his is much worse because of that. Are there any other questions regarding the bill as amended? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is on the first piece of that in subdivision 3, where it states receive other equitable relief as determined by the court, and then it turns around and says including relief and penalties referred to subdivision 3. Doesn't that take it right back to the same subdivision we're in? Wouldn't it make more sense to have just and penalties referred to instead of having relief in there twice?
Representative Mullery?
Chairman Lesh and Representative Howe, the reason I included relief is under subdivision 3 because relief under subdivision 3 says injunctions.
Representative Howe?
So if the Attorney General can get an injunction, the court should be able to order the injunction.
But my question, thank you, Master Chair. My question comes in, you've got equitable relief as determined by the court already. Why would we add including relief again? I guess that's where my question, it sounds redundant to me in bad language.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, I wanted to make sure that the court understood it could do an injunction just like if the Attorney General brought this action.
Representative Howe?
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's two different kinds of relief, and Representative Mullery is trying to include a reference to both kinds of relief so that the court knows they're permitted to enter both kinds of relief. Equitable and injunctive are different types of relief.
Any other questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you. I'd like a roll call on this, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been asked for. Seeing no other questions, the clerk will call the roll on House File 54 as amended.
Jim Lesh.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ellen.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Portman.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Neuberger.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Aye.
Representative Winkler.
Aye.
Representative Yarusto.
Aye.
Thank you.
Motion passes 8-7. Committee is in recess until 7 o'clock tonight.
...be assigned, but after review, they determined that assigning a group of people with all of the tools and information to respond to a borrower was a more workable requirement. If one employee was on vacation or sick or just busy with other customers, there are other employees with access to the customer's records and the authority to deal with the borrower. The CFPB requires servicers to have policies and procedures in place to achieve the objective of providing accurate and timely information to borrowers. They must attempt live contact by the 36th day that a payment is late. By 45 days, they have to assign personnel to the customer and send the customer information regarding loss mitigation options, like a modification, application instructions, contact information for foreclosure counseling, and contact information for servicer personnel. Once a borrower has applied for a loss mitigation option, the servicer must acknowledge the application in writing within 5 days, evaluate the borrower for all loss mitigation options, and provide a written decision within 30 days. If the borrower is denied, the borrower may appeal within 14 days, and the servicer would have 30 days to respond to the appeal. Servicers will have to follow these rules or be subject to enforcement actions. The CFPB will supervise the compliance of all banks with assets over $10 billion, and the federal regulatory agencies will examine all of the smaller banks for compliance with these rules. Section 4 of the bill requires a notice to service members 15 days before the notice of sale, stating that the borrower may be entitled to protections under the Service Members Civil Relief Act. Servicers are already required to send a one-page notice to all borrowers with information for service members. It gives them information about their rights under the Service Members Civil Relief Act and contact information for the Military One helpline. We believe this notice comes at a much more helpful time in the process than the one in the bill. This would come 45 days after the first payment is late. And the notice is repeated each time a borrower is 50 or 45 days late. Again, banks are examined for compliance with that statute as well. Section 7 of the bill addresses dual tracking. Dual tracking is prohibited in the bill and in the CFPB rules. The bill would delay or halt foreclosure for 90 days when a borrower requests a loan modification or other accommodation. Foreclosure may not begin or resume unless an accommodation is agreed to or denied. The bill would give the borrower a private right of action against a servicer, the power to stop a foreclosure by injunction, and the ability to get the sheriff's sale annulled. The CFPB's regulations would also prohibit dual tracking. A bank could not, or a servicer could not, initiate foreclosure during the first 120 days that a customer is delinquent. If a borrower completes an application for a loss mitigation option at least 37 days before the foreclosure sale, the servicer may not conduct the sale unless it's determined that the borrower doesn't qualify for that. As mentioned, there's an appeals process for those that have their loss mitigation applications denied. If a borrower submits an incomplete application, the servicer must acknowledge the incomplete application in writing and inform the borrower as to what information is missing within 5 days. There is a private right of action in the CFPB rules as well that would allow a consumer to sue the servicer for violating the dual tracking requirements. It covers both damages and costs, including attorney's fees. These rules are part of something called the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, as implemented by Regulation X, and that will preempt any state laws to the extent that they are inconsistent. And I do believe there are inconsistencies between what we're seeing in this bill and what is in the CFPB rules. So the CFPB would be the one to make a determination as whether they're preempted or not. Finally, Section 8 of the bill makes mediation mandatory. We're unclear how mediation will work with our existing laws regarding foreclosure counseling and the CFPB's timelines for all the loan modification opportunities. We just received those amendments, and so as I said, we haven't had a chance to look at those yet, but we were part of a working group that worked on comprehensive mandatory mediation, and that bill didn't become law, but some things have changed since then. Foreclosure counseling became a very important part of the foreclosure process, and now the federal government, of course, has stepped in with these federal rules governing servicers. Thanks to the Home Ownership Center, we know that foreclosures are at their lowest rate since 2006, and that in 2012, the foreclosure rate was less than 1% in Minnesota. We're unsure how this new mediation language would fit into the current process as well as with the CFPB rules. We believe that it will unduly complicate the process for lenders, and we're concerned it will also complicate the system for consumers when they're dealing with both different timelines for contacts and notices, loss mitigation agreements, and appeals. We do know that small lenders are already planning their exit from the mortgage market due to the complexity of these rules, the federal rules, and that small banks are selling or merging because they can't absorb the cost of complying. This, of course, will result in limiting the choice for consumers, particularly in rural Minnesota. And we believe that adding a second layer of state legislation will only exacerbate the situation. We also believe that the more difficult and uncertain it is to lend in Minnesota, the more expensive it will be for all Minnesotans to borrow. Lenders price their loans based on risk. And when the risk is that the foreclosure process may be stretched out indefinitely, or that there are two different dual tracking rules that must be followed, the cost will be higher than in a state where there is certainty and a reasonable time limit to the process. The MBA will continue to try to be a part of the process on this bill. We appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I can answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. Questions from members of the committee for Ms. Rice. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here to testify and bringing your prop there. I don't know how anybody weeds through that, and then to top this bill off and make it even more complicated, I think it's going to do, like you said, to confuse a lot of consumers. I want to thank you and all the lenders in this room. I know most everybody sitting around this table probably has a home loan through a lender or a bank. And unlike our chair in a press conference at noon today who said banks have worn out their welcome in Minnesota, in my opinion, I don't believe that, and I welcome you here. My question is, if there is a, you know, if these regulations that we're talking about here, if those are added to what you're looking at there, what is the net effect going to be on a lender's willingness to finance a home, say, in really a high foreclosure area like North Minneapolis or whatever? Are lenders going to be more or less likely to provide people the opportunity to own a home?
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, part of these rules make it much more difficult to qualify for a loan in the first place. There are new ability to pay standards that should basically wipe out that market that was for people who weren't traditional borrowers. So I do think that lending will be reduced everywhere. And if it is more difficult to foreclose or if the foreclosure period can go on forever, I think there will be many lenders that take a harder look at that. Most loans are sold on the secondary market, and so what will happen is the pricing will adjust for Minnesota to go along with that risk. So people will still be able to get loans, the standards will be higher, and it will cost more.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, that's all.
Other questions? Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rice, you said that the CFPB governs banks with assets over $10 billion, and there's a different federal agency that will implement those regulations with regard to smaller institutions. I missed the name.
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the CFPB rules apply to all banks, but the CFPB itself will only examine the very largest, over $10 billion in assets. So the Federal Reserve Bank, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the FDIC would be the primary federal regulators for other banks. And so they will come in with examination procedures for these rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering how many pages of those regulations deal with whether a homeowner has a right to mediation?
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative, mediation is not part of the CFPB rules.
Representative Horton.
You said that there's a private right of action for a violation of dual tracking in the regulations.
So I'm just wondering, is it the position of the Minnesota Bankers Association that the legislation authorizing the CFPB authorized a private right of action, and that is a right that exists for Minnesota homeowners?
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative, when these rules come into effect on January 10th, that right will exist for all Minnesota homeowners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rice, how will an individual homeowner in Minnesota avail themselves of the private right of action? Would they have to bring a case in federal court?
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know what? I don't know that. I'm sorry. I'm not a practitioner. We may have someone testify later who would understand that better than I.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're welcome. Representative Worman, any other questions for members of the committee from Ms. Rice? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Remind you, Representative Howe, we're down to 8 minutes left for opposition, so if you can be brief.
One question.
Go ahead, Representative Howe.
At any time, did the purveyor of the bill ever bring you into the discussion on developing this bill with all those current regulations you have stacked up there to see if how they applied and how they would work with the bill?
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, we were not brought into the process until after the bill was introduced.
Representative Howe? Any other questions from members for Ms. Rice? Thank you, Ms. Rice.
Thank you.
Kevin Dunleavy. Mr. Dunleavy, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I am co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. And thank you, Mr. Chair. The Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section, the focus of our committee is marketable title and protection of good faith purchasers. During the height of the foreclosure crisis in the 2008, 2009, and 2010 legislatures, I gave 550 pro bono hours and received the MSBA's President's Award for that effort. Most of the foreclosure remediation legislation that was passed during those three sessions was either conceived by, drafted by, or edited by me. My focus was to prevent goofing up the foreclosure process so that the titles to foreclosed property would remain marketable and that foreclosed properties wouldn't sit vacant outside the stream of commerce. This bill is not like any of those bills that were passed during the height of the foreclosure crisis, because this bill will goof up the foreclosure process, making title to foreclosed property unmarketable, resulting in more vacant properties. The bill is clearly well-intentioned, but the adverse consequences of this bill are more likely to hurt consumers and the state than it will benefit society. I spent about 10 hours doing a point-by-point memo analyzing House File 83, and I'm happy to share that with anybody here. If they have a hard time sleeping tonight, it'll be the perfect cure. And in that memo, I talked about the constitutional problems, I talked about the marketability problems, and about the legislative drafting problems with this bill. The amendment that was presented today addresses some of the drafting problems that I raised in my memo, but it doesn't address any of the constitutional law or marketability problems in my memo. The first constitutional problem is impairment of contracts. The United States and the Minnesota constitutions both prohibit impairment of contracts. This bill clearly impairs contracts because it eliminates the enforcement of mortgages by advertisement, by foreclosure by advertisement, under Chapter 580. There is a famous Supreme Court case in Minnesota called the Blaisdell case, which is an impairment of contracts case from the 1930s that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. There was also a Minnesota Supreme Court, I believe it's a Supreme Court case, that talks about farmer-lender mediation, which the mediation portions of this bill are largely tailored after, and that talks about impairment of contracts as well. All Minnesota mortgage forms have what's called the power of sale in them. This legislation effectively eliminates that enforceability by power of sale. And I'll explain that as we go along. So that's
With that comment, Mr. Dunleavy, as we go along, just so you know, you have There's 4 minutes left for all of the testifiers in opposition. Okay. Can I get a show of hands of who's here to testify in opposition to the bill? Two more individuals with 4 minutes left, Mr. Douglas.
Okay, I'll talk really fast. Second constitutional problem is due process. It's unconstitutional to take a property interest, in this case a mortgage, without notice and an opportunity for a hearing and just compensation. Some of the provisions of this bill make it impossible to foreclose, eliminating both the right of foreclosure by action and by advertisement. The debtor can simply make a series of loan modification requests under the dual tracking prohibition, and the creditor can never foreclose. That makes titles unmarketable because the making of titles unmarketable because of the procedural problems also has the effect of taking a property right in violation of the due process clause. The third constitutional problem is voidness for vagueness. Much of the terminology in this bill is incorrect. It's not correct terminology. I'm a real estate practitioner. I've been doing it for almost 30 years. This bill doesn't have it right. And much of it's ambiguous. For example, the phrase party foreclosing on a mortgage is not a term of art. That's not a term of art. It's not in Minnesota statutes anywhere. That's about what I would have said when I was a 15-year-old working at McDonald's to describe how to foreclose a mortgage. After 30 years of practice, I know that that's not the way you say it. Another example is a reference to the borrower's mortgage on lines 7.33 and 7.36. The borrower grants the mortgage. It's the creditor that owns the mortgage. This has it exactly backwards. My memo gives greater detail on the ambiguity and the incorrect terminology, and I don't want to spend the time with that. The marketability issues are the amendment eliminates the annulment of the share sale for violation of the dual tracking, but it's unclear what the remedy is. The remedy could still be avoidance. There's no statute of limitations, and there's no curative act. So presumably someone could sue to avoid a share sale by advertisement long after the share sale. There's no indication whether good faith purchasers are protected. There's no mechanism to protect good faith purchasers in this statute. The only way to prevent that from being a title problem would be to foreclose judicially and to get a court to determine that there wasn't dual tracking. So that effectively eliminates foreclosure by advertisement. That means about 20,000 foreclosures a year are going to have to go into the judicial system in order to be foreclosed by action. At the present rate of foreclosure, it's about 20,000 a year. That'll flood the court system. There are also technical issues. I don't think I have a lot of time to get into that. I think I'll leave that for my memo if anybody's interested in that.
Can you just wrap it up, final statement?
The summary is that this bill is well-intentioned, but because it's got constitutional problems, it's got problems with marketability, it's got numerous technical problems in the way it's drafted and in the way it deals with real estate, that it would be better not to pass this bill in its present form.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Mr. Skillbred, Representative Holbrook.
Very briefly, I would like a copy of your document.
Thank you. Mr. Dunleavy, you could provide those to members of the committee in an electronic version.
I can do that.
Thank you,
sir.
Mr. Skillbred. Mr. Skillbred, you've been left with 29 seconds left to present your testimony. We will go over a little bit, but please be very brief. Opposition has already been given more time than proponents on this. Mr. DiGiulio raised his hand, too. I would note that he's going to be cut off. Not only is he a constituent, but he is the husband of my CA, so my apologies, Mr. DiGiulio. Please proceed, Mr. Skipper.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'll try to be very brief. I'll make basically 2 points. Number one, with respect to the issue of the single point of contact prohibiting dual tracking, service member notice, previous testimony has ended that those issues have been resolved and acted upon at the federal level. To the extent that we would pass laws that were contrary or substantially or materially different, that would cause a conformity problem, especially with the small banks that I represent. My name, David Skillbred, represent the Independent Community Bankers in Minnesota. These are all small privately held banks. Second point has to do with the mandatory mediation. We are aware of mediation through the farmer lender mediation. There's one key point to keep in mind as you compare farmer lender to homeowner lender, and that is farmer lender mediation includes a business negotiating with a lender. Homeowners are not businesses. Businesses will have assets that they can put on the table. Homeowners typically don't. They're on W-2. So the question is, if two parties come to mediate, both need to have something to put on the table, and it's unclear to me if that would be the case in a homeowner-lender mediation. We were happy to work on the other bills that asked over the last 5 years or so. We were very glad to see the counseling initiative put into place for homeowners. How that would jive with mediation is questionable. With that, I'll end.
Thank you very much for your brevity, Mr. Skilbred. Event in time for proponents and opponents. Discussion from members of the committee. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions for Mr. Dunleavy.
Yes, Mr. Dunleavy. Representative Portman.
Thank you. Mr. Dunleavy, you testified that there are provisions of the bill that unconstitutionally impair contracts. Can you indicate which parts of the bill that you defined it?
It's Mr. Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's in my memo. I can send you a copy of that. But it's the short summary of it is that it makes it impossible to foreclose by advertisement because there's no way to prove up whether dual tracking occurs. So that means there is a cloud on every foreclosed title. The only way to eliminate that cloud is to foreclose judicially. So it eliminates the value of the power of sale language in the mortgage.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Dunleavy, so am I to understand the provision of the bill that forbids dual tracking says that if there has been dual tracking, then foreclosure is invalid?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it was until today's amendment, the language of the bill was that it was annulled. The sheriff's sale was annulled. That's not a term of art that I'm aware of in real estate law. Maybe it has something to do with matrimony. I think it's supposed to be void, but that provision was taken out by the amendment, but then that just begs the question of what's the remedy? The remedy is now not stated, and there's also no statute of limitations. So I think that means that if there was dual tracking, that under the common law, the borrower could sue to have the sale set aside. And since there is no statute of limitations, there's no way to protect a good faith purchaser under this law.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's
okay. I would note for members of the committee, Mr. DiGiulio passed out a Community Associations Institute of Minnesota Legislative Action Committee one sheet regarding his organization's opposition to the bill. Mr. Julie would be able to answer questions if members have questions about this. Okay, thank you. So if members have questions, they'll also be available for that. Other questions for members?
Mr. Chair, what's the motion? Where does this go next?
The bill was moved. It was recommended to pass to be referred to government operations.
Was the amendment adopted?
It was.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to request a roll call on the vote.
Roll call on the question. Other questions from members of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hogan.
I guess, the Civil Law Committee definitely has jurisdiction over constitutional issues. I'd like to hear from the bill author if he refutes the testimony of the gentleman from the bar who's an expert in foreclosure law and has spent all these hours with the other bills that have passed. I mean, we heard some pretty strong testimony about this bill and and directly related to issues under this committee's jurisdiction. So I'd like to hear from the author if he refutes that or if he's asking us to vote for an unconstitutional bill and send it to Gallat.
Representative Freiberg.
There were a few points there. I might look also to Ms. Mullen, who assisted with drafting this. And just for the record, I did. I received Mr. Dunleavy's comments, forwarded them to Ms. Mullen, and we worked to incorporate them. He raised a few points. Due process was one of them, and I believe his argument. I was trying to get his document on my phone while I was here, but unfortunately, I wasn't able. Purchased it under the cash. But on the due process point, for example, his argument was that on the dual tracking provision, there's no process whereby an amendment can be rejected, or that, you know, basically the mortgage servicer is stuck with it. Point 6 of the bill, you know, it says in there clearly that the mortgage servicer shall not start or continue foreclosure even after the 90 days have passed unless, one, the servicer has provided notice to the borrower that the borrower's request has been rejected, including an explanation for why the request was rejected. So the authority to reject a request for modification is in there. Void for vagueness. I mean, if there's a term, you know, I think the term part, you know, he referenced a person working at McDonald's, but in my mind, the term party foreclosing on a mortgage is pretty clear. That was one of the changes made in suggestion in response to his comments. Certainly happy to work with him as this process moves forward to see if there's a term he would view as more clear. And I am forgetting something. Ms. Mullen, is there... I forget. Did you have anything to add on those 2 points? But those would be my...
Well, I would ask this. Was there anything that he left out that was unclear to you, Representative Holbrook, that you wanted him to address specifically?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that he answered all the concerns on the testimony regarding the stylistic language. I don't know why we would not be fixing that. If we have somebody here who's an expert on the last 28 bills related to mortgage and foreclosure that have been done in the state, he's a member of the bar. I, as a non-lawyer, listen to these folks as being the experts in their field in various areas of practice. I don't know that GovOps is the place to fix these issues, quite frankly, but you're the chair and he's the author. So at this point, I'm not willing to support the bill in its current form. And most of the foreclosure legislation that we've passed around here has been bipartisan with all parties at the table working through that. And I don't see a lot of that in this situation either.
Representative Holbrook, my understanding of bill path is government operations, commerce, and judiciary. Judiciary would certainly have jurisdiction over some courts issues, including constitutional. I do expect that this bill is worked on in the future. But Representative Liebing, did you have something to speak to?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say that I understood that this bill has a few other stops. And I was just going to ask if Representative Freiberg, you know, he seems quite amenable to making this bill work and listening to people who have technical concerns, really, about it. And so I just really wanted to ask him, just to put it clearly, whether he intends, as the bill moves along, to remedy some of these problems. I'm sure that he does, and I think he'll have plenty of opportunity to do that if he's willing to.
Absolutely. Just yesterday, both the Senate author, Senator Torres Rey, and myself met with the Attorney General's office, and then we met as part of a larger meeting that had representatives of the banks, the credit unions, the counselors. I'm forgetting at least a few people who were involved in that. It has been evolving. This is the second version. There were amendments made in response to their concerns. In the Housing Committee, there were here, and I anticipate there will be in the future, and I'm very open to working with all the parties who are involved.
Representative Liebing.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. I mean, obviously we want it to work. Nobody wants to pass a bill, a law, make a law that is going to hurt the people we're trying to help or that isn't going to work. And so, you know, I guess I would just say to the members that with there's plenty of time, and with Representative Freiberg's commitment to that, I certainly would be willing to support his bill.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone who carried the homeowner lender mediation bill for, I think, 4 or 6 years, I worked on it, and I got it to the governor's desk once to be vetoed and once almost to the governor's desk. This is a very heavy lift that I know you're working on. I do have some concerns with what's in the bill, and I've spoken to you about those, and I think that a lot of work needs to get done, but I had the benefit of members' support in helping me with homeowner lender mediation in order to work out the kinks and the issues with all of the parties. Again, it ended up passing bipartisanly and then got vetoed, but as long as you're committed to working with all of the parties that are interested, including me, who happens to be interested in this issue, I'm happy to move it along, but I do have to tell you that I do have some concerns, and I think there is a lot of work to be done, having done it for a long time.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard a couple of references to the numbers of regulations. We had the stack of papers and whatnot. And, you know, this is a complex industry, and I don't know that there's a magic number of regulations that's the right thing. When you've got an industry that there's practically no one in the country that thinks that it didn't have problems a few years ago. And so it's a complex thing to undo the state that we had gotten into. And so I don't really think that a certain magic number of we've done 28 or 38 or whatever it was, and so we should be done, is really relevant. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, with some of the testimony we had, I just want to clarify a couple things. If a bank would start the foreclosure process and the person requested a loan modification, the foreclosure process would stop?
Yes.
Senator Freiberg.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Yes, unless the servicer has responded to the request with a rejection, or that's the language I cited on 7.26.
Representative Johnson.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, how many opportunities would if the bank would start the foreclosure process again, and if they start loan modification again, keep starting and stopping? My concern is if it gets too much like that, the banks are just going to quit refusing to do mortgages in Minnesota altogether, and nobody's going to own a home.
Representative Freiberg.
The original version, I guess the way I'd answer that, the original version of this bill was based off of a law that passed in California, the California Homeowners Bill of Rights, and it has dual tracking provisions in there, and in California the mortgage market is doing fine. I'm not saying this is the final version of the bill, but I am confident. I'm confident it can be done in a way that will not impair negatively the mortgage market.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg. I've been in law enforcement for a number of years, serving numerous, I don't know how many foreclosure papers, and understanding the process on the service end of it. If there's a stop in the process, involving the paper service, the entire process has to start all over again. So every time there's a stop in the foreclosure process, for over a certain length of time, the whole process has to start over again. And I think if we end up making it too restrictive on the process for the foreclosure, we will never we'll end up seeing home ownership in Minnesota.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions for the author. First of all, have you requested a fiscal note on this? Because I know the mediation is going to head to courts.
Yes.
Representative Freiberg.
I'm sorry. Yes, it's expected to be ready tomorrow.
Okay, great. And then in your cooperative talks that you're talking about having with the stakeholders and stuff, would you be willing to invite Mr. Dunleavy here, since he seems to be the expert?
Representative Freiberg.
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last question. you know, there's these fines for $500 at different stops within the process here that you've laid out. And who's going to enforce those penalties, I guess?
Representative Freiberg.
The penalties were, it's not an arbitrary amount, just first of all. Within the foreclosure chapter of Minnesota statutes, there are, actually the one that was in the landlord-tenant portion, there were some penalties in there for $100, some in there for $500. I figure these are really important, and they're, to me, $100 to a servicer, if the law is violated, doesn't seem like a large amount. So I opted for the larger figure. That's where the number came from.
Oh, and that's not. Scott. Thank sure. you. That's not the question I'm asking. I'm asking who's going to enforce it.
So, perhaps Ms. Mullen. Sure, perhaps Ms. Mullen could help with this. I don't have the portion involving the enforcement agency is not in the bill.
Sure.
Ms. Mullen.
Chairman and Representative Scott, the civil penalties are, I believe, intended to be used through a civil action. So if you were suing based on a violation of, for example, the single point of contact, you would probably be suing for damages, but you'd be suing for also for your civil penalty.
So that would further tie up, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair,
Scott.
That would further tie up the courts then for that action.
That's a better question for
Representative. Yeah,
Representative Freiberg.
Sure. If the law is broken, that's what the courts are there to fix that problem.
Representative Scott.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Freiberg. You and I have had a lot of conversation today and yesterday, and I have a lot of concerns about this bill, especially with Mr. Dunleavy's testimony. And I know that you're coming from a good place in your heart and that this is well-intended, but it really needs a lot of work. And I want your commitment that you're going to work with Mr. Dunleavy and all the stakeholders to make this bill something that I can vote for and that we all can vote for, because it's well-intentioned, but it needs a lot of work, and I understand that. And I want to see it get to a point where I can vote for it.
You have my commitment. I'm sorry. You have my commitment.
Any other questions for members of the committee or the author? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just had a comment. As a pilot, I've come up with a lot of analogies that work with aviation. And in this situation, I look at this as an airplane pre-flight. And this bill, as it's written right now, would not pass a pre-flight, which means I'm not going to get on board that airplane. There are some serious concerns by members on both sides here, and what I mean by I wouldn't get on the airplane means this is sloppy. There's something wrong with it. To pass it out of here and send it on to someplace else to me just seems wrong. That's just my comment. I think we need to fix it here because we need to see what's going on. I don't see that we should be passing this off to anybody else. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Any other comments, questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then, before we call the roll on this, Representative Freiberg, it's not normally my habit to make comments about these prior to a vote, but when Ms. Rice was testifying regarding the costs being driven up for homeowners or people who were trying to buy homes if this bill were to pass, I was looking at Ms. McGee, and I was wondering what the costs were for her under the current system and how that drove up the costs for her and the innumerable people who have been foreclosed on in the state of Minnesota. And Representative Scott, you didn't get my quote right, or your staffer didn't get my quote right, but absolutely, at the rally today, I stated that the banks have worn out their welcome in some Minnesota homes. And the fact remains that on Representative Anderson's comments about the sloppiness, there has been extraordinary sloppiness in the state of Minnesota on the part of some lending institutions. I have personally experienced that, and people in this room have personally experienced that. Clerk will call the roll.
Chairman Lesh.
Aye.
Vice Chair Illen.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hoberg.
No.
Representative Portman.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Lewis. Leaving.
Aye.
Representative Neuberger.
Not at this time.
No. Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Pass.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Simon. Representative Winkler.
Aye.
Representative DeRusso.
Aye.
Bill passes on a vote of 8-7. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.